Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Trent Lott's political fate hangs in the balance tonight, with support eroding within his own party. Senate Republicans will huddle next month to decide if he will remain their majority leader. The senator from Mississippi has been embroiled in controversy since early November for remarks made at the 100th birthday party of retiring Senator Strom Thurmond that appeared to praise the racial segregation platform of Thurmond's 1948 campaign for the presidency.
I want to say this about my state. When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him. We're proud of it. And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years either.
Lott has repeatedly apologized for those words, but the damage appears to be done. The president has denounced his remarks. Liberals, arch-conservatives, and political rivals have all taken their knives out. And Lott's words illuminate an old race card association that the GOP is desperate to leave behind. So should Trent Lott stay or should he go? And why is American politics still battling along black and white lines after all these years? Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from Washington tonight is Tom Edsel, political correspondent with The Washington Post and author of Chain Reaction, The Impact of Race, Rights, and Taxes on American Politics. Good evening and welcome, Tom Edsel.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello to both Toms.
Two Toms. Tom Edsel, take us into the very latest here. Trent Lott appears to be getting pushed onto the ropes. What's the latest today?
Today, basically, the Republicans have decided to hold a caucus to decide whether or not to have a new election for leader and whether or not to replace Lott.
So is this hopeful for Trent Lott hanging on to his position or not?
No. This is there's a growing consensus that they had to do this. The very fact they had to do it is a setback to him. A lot of senators are now coming out and saying, we need to have something to straighten out. We have to get an agenda passed. They're not saying they're going to vote against Lott, but they are certainly sending bad signals to him. Does not look good for him. And the president is signaling that he has very cold feet about keeping Lott in office.
How exactly is that signal coming? Ari Fleischer would not put distance between the president and Lott today, but he wasn't very supportive either, was he?
Well, by the very fact of not being supportive, and then in background conversations, mm-hmm. White House people are saying repeatedly they felt that the president was not happy with any of Lott's variety of apologies, that they think his body language was bad, that his reference to race mixed crowds was awkward and convoluted, that he did not seem to be particularly contrite. All of the messages are really pretty devastating to have from a president of your own party.
So, Tom Edsel, who is lining up with Trent Lott? Who's lining up against him? What's the rationale for who ends up on which side within the Republican Party? How are the lines being drawn here? Can you tell yet?
Well, there's no real rationale in an objective sense. There are people who Lott has developed relationships with in the Senate that he's taken care of. Mitch McConnell, who is the incoming whip, has been very supportive. Rick Santorum, who's head of the conference, Republican conference, has been very
Pennsylvania.
Supportive.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who Lott has helped along the leadership ladder. Don Nichols, who does not like Lott and ran for majority whip underneath him over Lott's objections, would like to knock him out, and he is the one leading the charge against him.
And we're hearing quite a bit of complaint from arch-conservative quarters. The word is that it's very strong conservatives in some cases who really want to see Trent Lott go. Why is that?
The real groundswell of opposition against Lott is from sort of the new conservative right, the Weekly Standard, even the old right, the National Review. Mm-hmm. These people see the image of the Republican Party as being racist as being what's really holding it up now from being a majority party. For years, race issues worked very well and very effectively for the Republican Party. We're, I think, at a juncture now where Hispanics and suburban voters, especially well-educated, fairly professionally trained suburban voters, have become key to winning elections. And a racial strategy based focused on the white South, which is now virtually all Republican, and there's no more gain to be made there, and on working-class whites isn't effective. Working-class whites in their numbers are declining. Hispanics are growing, mm-hmm. and white professionals are growing, and they are the two groups they have to go after.
Jack Beatty, there's a gear shift that Republicans devoutly want to make. Trent Lott's remarks don't make that any easier, but his remarks do come within a historical context, a pattern.
Well, they do, and it really begins, I think, as so much in modern Republican politics, with the Goldwater campaign of 1964. In that campaign, Barry Goldwater lost 61-38 to LBJ, but something like 4 million people actively worked for the campaign, and whereas 44,000 people contributed to Nixon in 1960 and only 22,000 to JFK, over a million contributed to Goldwater in 64. In short, the Goldwater campaign was a movement as much as anything else. And one of its main props was Goldwater's repudiation of the Civil Rights Act. And he did that at the urging of his advisor, William Rehnquist, whom Nixon appointed to the court and whom Reagan appointed Chief Justice. So I think that's the line, you see, of mm-hmm. Republican anti-civil rights, almost institutionalized in the person of Chief Justice Rehnquist, who comes right out of that Goldwater campaign.
Tom Edsel, how heavy, how current is the Republican burden of race politics?
Well, it's basically it's ongoing. In the last presidential election, neither Bush nor McCain was willing to repudiate or criticize southern states for flying the Confederate flag over their state capitals. The opposition to affirmative action still remains quite strong. Race is just a very central issue and will remain a central issue.
And in Trent Lott's case, is he seen as epitomizing the old racial dynamic of the GOP, or is he just one among many?
Well, I think he's seen as being, by now, by a segment of the Republican Party, as being really an anachronism. To be calling, to be suggesting that segregation is something that would have been good to have endorsed through the election of Strom Thurmond, that's really pushing the margins way beyond being opposed to affirmative action, say, or being opposed to busing or whatever.
Tom Edsel, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Earl Black. He's joining us from Bel Air, Texas. He's professor of political science at Rice University, co-author of Southern Republicans, and one of the most eminent interpreters of Southern politics. Good evening and welcome, Earl Black.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us. Earl Black, help us understand the context of Trent Lott's remarks. He's done a lot to try and distance himself from those remarks, but we heard at the top of the hour the tape of that those remarks, and you could hear the laughter, the cheers, the kind of groundswell of positive response at Strom Thurmond's birthday party to that. Is this way, way outside of Republican history, or is it within the stream of Republican political history? What's the dynamic?
Now, Trent Lott comes out of the conservative segregationist Democratic Party. That was his original background. He served for several years as the chief of staff for William Comer, who was an arch segregationist Southern Democrat, head of the Rules Committee, mm-hmm. back in the old unreformed days. And Lott made his switch in 1972 when Comer retired, and Trent Lott instantly changed from conservative Democrat to conservative Republican, elected in 1972 to the House. I think one of the things that's interesting about Lott is he's now been in national politics for 30 years. Mm-hmm. He is one of the oldest Republicans now serving in either the House, Southern Republicans now serving in either the House or the or the Senate.
So he has more history than most.
Absolutely right, and I think that with Trent Lott, you know, in comparison to his other Senate colleague from Mississippi, Tad Cochran, Tad Cochran was always more of a New South Republican. Outreach programs to blacks started much earlier with Cochran, more of a sincere effort. And the exit polls suggest that he does better among black voters than Trent Lott. With Lott, there is, I think, a lot of that blue-collar, southern, working-class heritage that has now carried him into a leadership position and puts him diametrically at odds with the President of the United States, George W. Bush, who I think has been working pretty hard back from his days as governor of Texas to turn the Republican Party into a much more inclusive political party. And you know, Bush's remarks last week rebuking Trent Lott, I think, not that Bush wanted the incident to occur, mm-hmm. but it gave him the opportunity, I think, to contrast a new role model for the Republicans, that is, Bush Republicans, versus now what is, I think, you know, as Tom Edsel was saying, in some ways, a more anachronistic approach that dates back to the even pre-Barry Goldwater days.
Well, we read that on the day that the Civil Rights Act was signed, LBJ turned to Bill Moyers and said, "There goes the South to the Republican Party." That effectively came to pass, did it not? And how deliberate a policy of playing the race card did the Republicans use to win that South, or did it just fall into their lap?
Well, I think the Barry Goldwater presidential campaign, Goldwater was actually one of a very few Republican senators who didn't support the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act was passed with a huge bipartisan northern majority, mm-hmm. Democrats and Republicans. Mm-hmm. In the South, there were 22 Southern senators, 21 Democrats, one Republican, John Tower of Texas, and 20 of those 21 Democrats voted against the Civil Rights Act. Ralph Yarborough of Texas was the only Southern Democrat who supported it.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, the segregationist tradition was really very strong in the Democratic Party. Of course, there really weren't many Republicans in the House, and only one in the Senate. The Goldwater phenomenon translated into success in 1964 only in the Deep South states. Goldwater didn't carry the entire South. He carried only the five Deep South states, the states with the largest black populations, including Mississippi. I think probably 90-95% of white voters in Mississippi in 1964 voted for Barry Goldwater. That was the context in which Trent Lott was born and raised.
Earl Black, and yet it's only last month that Trent Lott was at the birthday party making these remarks. How well do you think the new Republican strategy, the inclusive face of the Republican Party, sits on the American South today?
Oh, I think President Bush in making the marks critical of Lott, I think was really speaking for a whole lot of the middle class South, for whom the burden of being perceived as racist is one that they would really like to get rid of. And I think that you know, what's really kind of striking about the Lott controversy is I really can't think of very many people except really fringe operations that have come out in any kind of support for Lott. You know, when Lott made his remarks at that birthday celebration, I think there was initial a positive response, but then when he went ahead and identified that with saying that the nation would have been better off, it seemed to me like there was a lot of kind of shock silence. This was not, you know, this was not what those people at the birthday party, I think, expected to, you know, to hear at all. So I think what we have right now is a very interesting contrast between President Bush presenting a very different image of the Republican Party versus Trent Lott, who now, by virtue of reporting that's going on, is locked into a variety of statements that, that just undermine his ability to be a credible leader for the Republican Party in the Senate.
Earl Black, Tom Edsel, Jack Beatty, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're going to come right back. We're talking tonight about Trent Lott hanging by a thread and race politics in the GOP and in America. You can join the conversation. Should Trent Lott stay or should he go? And how much of GOP thinking on race does Trent Lott reflect? A little? A throwback? Something more? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about race in American politics and the fallout from comments made by Mississippi Senator Trent Lott for the Republican Party, which has worked to shed its white boy club image. The remarks were not welcome. President Bush joined in the sharp distancing.
Any suggestion that the segregated past was acceptable or positive is offensive, and it is wrong. Recent comments by Senator Lott do not reflect the spirit of our country.
So, what do you think? Should Trent Lott stay or go? What role does race play in GOP politics today, in American politics? And why are blacks and whites so segregated by party, especially in the South? Is it by accident, by Democrats' design, by Republican design? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Thomas Edsel, political correspondent for The Washington Post. Earl Black joining us from Bel Air, Texas tonight, professor of political science at Rice University, and by our own Jack Beatty. Thomas Edsel, here we are, President Bush making a strong statement, putting a lot of distance, all he could, between himself, his position, the party, and Trent Lott. Is that an accurate reflection of how things really play out in elections? Is the Republican Party having a little bit of both ways here, publicly distancing itself from all that and yet, in some dimension, profiting from the race card when it's voting time, election day?
Well, they do profit from a very high white margin in the South, and they have profited from picking up formerly Democratic white voters, especially in working class areas surrounding places like Chicago and Detroit. I think what's going on is, though, that the Bush administration is trying to develop an agenda that they hope will appeal to minorities and really as much to Hispanics as to blacks, but they want to take the edge off of the sort of the black liability that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important for them strategically, and if they're going to survive as a party and be competitive, large-scale demographic trends are not favorable to the Republican Party as it currently stands.
Mm-hmm.
And their own pollsters say that if they had sort of the same groups voting for them and the same percentage in 2004 as in 2000, Bush's vote would be smaller and it would get smaller and smaller as you go through presidential years. So they have to expand out, and the places they have to expand are Hispanics and with more upscale, socially liberal whites, socially liberal on civil rights, not necessarily in economics.
On socially liberal whites, which means they cannot look like a racial throwback.
They cannot. And that's a fatal error for them. It's a problem for the Republican Party in that not all Republicans agree with this strategy. You have many, especially in the House of Representatives, where you have Republicans who have very conservative districts,
mm-hmm.
and all they care about is really having a primary from their own right. They're never threatened in the general election, and they don't really have a compassionate conservative agenda in their mind. They want to stay pretty basically hard right.
Jack Beatty, I want to bring you in here. As Tom Edsel describes it, the Republican Party has little choice but to really reject the history of the race card if it wants to survive and flourish.
Yes, and recent polls show that they have an opening even among African Americans. In a poll done this fall by the Joint Center, Bush's favorability rating, well, among African Americans, went from 29% in 2000 to 50.8% in 2002. Meanwhile, the party identification for the Democrats fell from 74% to 63% among African Americans, and it went from 4% in 2000 for the GOP to 10% today. That shows there's some sort of opening there. But when you look further in the poll, African Americans favor the Democrats on race relations by 53% to 13%. And this sort of publicity around Senator Lott works right at that particular vulnerability. So that on the one hand, the president, through his faith-based initiative, is, I think, trying skillfully, politically, to detach black voters from strict liberals who don't want any church-state relations.
And that is by diverting some money to churches, maybe black churches, who will then carry out social services.
That's right. And I think his voucher program on education, I think we're going to hear more about that this year, is also aimed to detach black voters from unions, from the teachers' union, which is against it, and sort of split the Democratic coalition. So Bush has some cards here, and along comes Lott to remind everybody of the GOP's really generation-long flirtation, at least in the South and through code in the North, with the race issue.
So Earl Black, you followed this trajectory for a long time. Does it make sense to you now? Does it feel accurate that the Republicans are they climbing on to a glide path that will take them to a more mainstream, comfortable position on race, that they can make the kind of generational jump that Tom Edsel's describing to a more multicultural U.S. polity?
You know, the first generation of Southern Republicans came out of the civil rights legislation, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act of 64, the George Wallace movement of the mid-1960s mm-hmm. into the early 1970s. And a lot of that first generation of Southern Republicanism, especially in the Deep South, not so much in some of the peripheral South states, but especially in the Deep South, was what I refer to as primitive Republicanism, where there was a very hard racial tinge to it. And that was carried out in a variety of ways. And I might add that during the 60s and 70s in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, one of the problems for the Southern Republicans was that they were frequently facing incumbent Southern Democrats who were quite conservative on race, but had the advantage of seniority, being part of a majority party. And so the conservative Southern Democrats frequently smothered these primitive Republicans in a lot of elections for the House. Mm-hmm. Now, by the 1980s, those conservative white Democrats were dying off, retiring, and they were increasingly replaced by younger Democrats who are very comfortable making biracial coalitions. And they used those very effectively to defeat a lot of the Republicans during the 1980s, because the downside of the Republicans is once they had put themselves into a big hole where they could no longer expect to get more than a 5 to 10% of black support, mm-hmm. they dug a huge hole for themselves, then the only way they can possibly win is with substantial white majorities, depending on the racial composition of the state or the district. And that meant that in many cases, Republicans weren't electable because they couldn't put together those coalitions. Now I think we have a situation where in the South, particularly in the southern suburbs, you have a huge middle class mm-hmm. that really didn't exist 40 to 50 years ago. Mm. And that's the heart of the Republican effort.
And that middle class is mainly white. I hear Tom Edsel saying yes. It's not so much that Republicans have to actually get the black vote, just appear liberal enough on the race front to attract moderate suburban middle-class Republicans.
You know, I think a lot of the Republican, Southern Republican candidates in the 90s and early part of this century are well aware that their political fate would be so much more secure if they could substantially increase their support among blacks. Mm-hmm. They find it very hard to do it because the Democrats, have worked very hard to maintain those extremely high levels of black cohesion, and
right.
there are all kinds of reasons why that's the case.
But it takes two parties to tango here.
That's right. But I think what we see in the Bush presidency for the first time is a Republican president who is willing to basically project an image of inclusiveness in all kinds of ways. This didn't happen with Bush's father. It certainly didn't happen to Ronald Reagan. Didn't happen with Richard Nixon.
But George W. Bush is very determined to project that picture. David's on the line. Hi, David. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much. Yeah, I just, you know, like I told the person who answered the phone, I consider myself to be a very liberal person, maybe even ultra-liberal. But I just think that lots of comments were made, and he just wasn't thinking about what he was saying. I mean, I personally don't think that he is a racist. I think that he made a mistake. And it's an important mistake. It is something that should be called out. But I don't think that Bush actually has a leg to stand on.
When he criticizes Trent Lott for his statement,
yeah,
you mean?
I mean, well, when I first turned into your show, I heard somebody talking about Bush's reluctance to say anything about the Confederate flags flying over state capitals. Mm. Now, I think that Bush had a wonderful opportunity to hear at this point to talk about the symbolism of Confederate flags, about you know, unthoughtful comments like this, and really move you know, a discussion forward about where we are in terms of racism.
Well, but David, our guests are saying that the president is moving that discussion forward, that he's in rejecting Trent Lott's comments.
No, I don't think so. I think he's sort of saying Trent Lott is different from the rest of us, and maybe he should be punished somehow, but he's not admitting his own guilt or the collective guilt of the country.
David, we've got it. I want to put that to Earl Black. Earl, when you heard what Trent Lott said, David saying it didn't necessarily sound that bad to him. It just sounded like a misstatement. Put this in context for us with Trent Lott.
I was flabbergasted when I read Trent Lott's statement, because what he was implicitly defending there or praising was the segregationist platform that Strom Thurmond, then a Democrat running for president as a state's writer, was putting forward in 1948. It was just unbelievable that the leader of the Republican Party in the Senate of the United States would say such a thing. You know, it just reflected a complete absence of thoughtfulness about what he thought he was trying to accomplish.
Earl Black, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I know we have to let you go, but thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Earl Black is professor of political science at Rice University and joined us from Bel Air, Texas. He's co-author of Southern Republicans. I want to welcome into our conversation now Hillary Shelton. He's director of the Washington Bureau of the NAACP. Good evening and welcome, Hillary Shelton.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. You have, of course, heard and read Trent Lott's comments. You've seen the response. What do you make of all this, Hillary Shelton? Is the Republican pushback against Trent Lott an indication that this party is now determined to move away from a past that just doesn't go down well anymore?
Well, I think you have to look at how long a path it is first. As you know, African-Americans voted Republican because Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, and quite frankly, he freed the slaves, and we were indebted and felt that he represented our interests, so we voted Republican. It wasn't until the New Deal, then moving into the Civil Rights Movement of the 60s, we began to vote consistently more Democratic because people, African Americans, believed that the Democrats represented their interests, their concerns. So as we move forward, and certainly as we're looking at what Trent Lott's doing, there's a history even behind the Trent Lotts of the Republican Party. What you're talking about is people that started out as Democrats became Dixiecrats, and then from being Dixiecrats became Republicans.
But is he the strange odd man out at this point, Hillary Shelton, or are you buying the Republican push to change, push to be different, because it must be different to continue to succeed demographically in this multicultural country of ours?
Well, you know, first you've got to look at it two ways. One is you're looking at what he's saying. People are outraged about what Trent Lott said, as they were outraged about what other members of the House or Senate have said. But it's not just what they say, it's what they do. It's not just, as they say, talking the talk, it's also walking the walk. As we look at people like Trent Lott, we're looking at someone that has said some really troubling, disturbing, even racist things. But we're also talking about someone who votes very, very badly. I run the NAACP's Washington Bureau in D.C. This is the division of the NAACP that pushes the NAACP's legislative agenda on Capitol Hill, but also rates the members of the House and Senate on how they vote on the bread-and-butter civil rights legislative agenda.
All right.
And what we see when we look at Trent Lott's record is we're seeing someone that votes in a way that's consistent with the things that he has said.
But if he should go, Hillary Shelton, do you see a new Republican Party having emerged or emerging? Is he kind of a last holdover in the attitude or the low score that you've given him?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. As a matter of fact, what we've seen, again, is a consistency. He votes very badly. There's some people that hadn't said the things publicly that he said that also vote very badly. You talk about Trent Lott. You also have to talk about Orrin Hatch from Utah. Orrin Hatch from Utah is not under attack for anything he said. But indeed, Orrin Hatch votes in a way that's extremely troubling and problematic to the African-American community. If we look at other Republicans and other members of the House and Senate, you see people that vote very badly on a civil rights, bread-and-butter legislative agenda.
Tom Edsel, I want to bring you back in here. Tom Edsel with The Washington Post. Yeah. Is it fair to let the fire that's touching Trent Lott now touch the rest of the Republican Party? Hillary Shelton says he is not alone, but we've heard a lot about the Republicans' efforts to embrace a racially diverse country.
I think it is a little dangerous to try to sort of do a guilt by association of every Republican that Trent Lott is emblematic of the whole GOP. I don't think, one, that his comments are emblematic, and two, I think the Republican Party is in the state of struggling to redefine its identity.
Mm-hmm.
It's had I think the previous caller was correct in saying that Bush's record has a lot that are there are a lot of questions that could be raised about it. And what's striking is really that the Trent Lott situation is the first time he has spoken out against a major interest in his own party on race. He has been very reluctant to do that in the past. But this time he took on his own majority leader in the Senate.
And yet the Senate, the fellow senators and Republicans of Trent Lott knew his history, must have had some inkling of his attitudes. Has there been an ongoing conversation about this with Trent Lott? Have people been concerned that this is not the guy we want to have leading the Republicans in the Senate when we're expanding the party's base? Or was it just this one remark that brought it all to the fore?
I think it's, in fact, well, having written stories way back in 1998 about Trent Lott and his involvement with this group called the Council of Conservative Citizens,
mm-hmm.
When there was almost no real echo chamber, this event here has really hit a nerve. And I have to admit that as someone who's covered a lot of these things over the years, it's quite surprising that the intensity of that nerve.
Hillary Shelton, are you heartened in some degree at the Republican pushback against Trent Lott? Do you think this marks a turning point or another evolutionary point?
Well, I think it's good to see that this kind of an attitude, this kind of opposition to inclusion in our government is something that should be pushed back against. It's refreshing to see these concerns being lifted. The question is still, even George Bush criticizes Trent Lott, he's not saying what he wants Lott to do. In his comments, he said what Lott said was wrong, but he didn't say Lott should step down as majority leader.
Well, he hasn't yet. It looks like he may still. Hillary Shelton, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Happy to be with you.
Hillary Shelton is director of the Washington Bureau of the NAACP. We are talking tonight about Trent Lott hanging by a thread. Should he stay or should he go as the Senate Republican majority leader? Trent Lott says it was just a poor choice of words. Do you buy that? Do you accept his apology? We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. We're joined by Thomas Edsel of the Washington Post and our own Jack Beatty. Andrew Sullivan joins us after the break. You can join us too, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Trent Lott hanging by a thread to the Senate majority leadership position in the U.S. Senate. What do you think? Should Trent Lott stay or should he go? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Thomas Edsel, political correspondent for The Washington Post and author of Chain Reaction, The Impact of Race, Rights, and Taxes on American Politics. You can join us as well. Jerry's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I think that last comment show that race does play a part in the GOP. I mean, if you just look at the criminal justice system and turns the apathy that the GOP shows towards black defendants in terms of DNA testing, access to competent lawyers in death penalty cases, they play to the fears of a conservative white majority, and they wonder why they're losing votes, why blacks aren't voting for them in droves. There's reasons for this.
So you're not willing to hang it all on Trent Lott?
I don't think it's just all Trent Lott. There's many Republicans. Now, different Republicans are different. They're more liberal Republicans. Mm-hmm. But they're not all. A lot of them are apathetic to the concerns of blacks. And this is just one way, the rights of defendants in death penalty cases. They do not look at these areas. They do not look at the rights of blacks to vote, and such as the state of Florida in the last election. They just ignore these issues.
We got it. Jack Beatty, Jerry says this just doesn't smell right. It can't be as narrowly posted as on Trent Lott's shoulders, and it's a broader deal.
It is indeed a broader deal. I mean, consider John Ashcroft, the attorney general. He gave an extensive interview to Southern Partisan magazine a few years ago. This magazine writes pieces sometimes saying that maybe the assassination of President Lincoln wasn't such a bad idea. When John McCain was fighting for his political life in the South Carolina primary, President George Bush went to Bob Jones University to try to play the race card there, since they are against interracial dating. That didn't stop him from speaking there. And John McCain, the man he put in charge of his campaign in South Carolina, was one of the editors of this Southern Partisan magazine. But it goes beyond that. I mean, it's part and parcel of the GO. I mean, there are very few Republican senators or representatives who are for affirmative action, it seems to me. And then it goes even broader into American life. Sure, segregation de jure is over, but segregation de facto in residential housing and neighborhoods, that's the American way of life. I mean, the density of segregation in northern cities now is higher than it is in the South.
But how much of that can you hang on Republican shoulders?
Oh, I'm not hanging it all on Republicans, but I'm saying that this broader question of segregation is part of how America is set up.
Jerry, thank you for your call from Milwaukee. Tom Edsel, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome Andrew Sullivan joining us from Provincetown, Massachusetts. He writes a daily column on his website, andrewsullivan.com, and is a senior editor at the New Republic magazine. Good evening and welcome, Andrew Sullivan.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. So, Andrew Sullivan, should Trent Lott stay? Should he go?
Oh, he should go. And I said that not this Sunday, but the last Sunday. I was one of the first to say it.
Early on.
I read his remarks. And I think it's not simply because of an attitude. It's because he made an argument. It wasn't a gaffe. It was an actual argument that the Thurmond, if he had won 48, the country would have been a better place. That's what puts this in a whole new dimension. It isn't catching someone out in some gaffe or smear or slur. It is an actual credible argument which Lott's entire political history seems to suggest is not inconsistent with what he actually believes.
So Andrew That's Sullivan, conservative, Republican, you believe that this is what Trent Lott really believes? Even today, it wasn't just kind of a sentimental old sop to an old man who was once an arch segregationist?
I don't know what he believes. None of us can know what's mm-hmm. in his heart. And that's not the question here.
Mm-hmm.
The question is that he clearly does not, in any of his statements or actions, he has not internalized the notion that the civil rights movement is a bedrock of this country's current racial progress and is a critical moral achievement in the United States. And if you don't acknowledge that, if you haven't internalized that, you're just not in the mainstream of American politics. And you can certainly be a senator, but you shouldn't be a leader of a major political party in the way he is. I want to say something about Jack, who's trying to push this way too far in saying that somehow all Republicans are racist, or that if you don't support affirmative action, you're somehow racist. That's pushing it way too far. The reason for this is that Lott has actually supported a system of racial identification and segregation in his comments that is clearly dividing the country along grounds of race. I think that one should oppose affirmative action for the very same reason, that it is also a new kind of segregation. It's a new kind of racism put forward by liberals. And if you're going to make that argument, however, you've got to avoid the possibility people call you a racist, as Jack does. But you're not. In order to prove that, you have to get rid of the Trent Lotts of this world.
Do you think he'll go?
Yes, I do. I think it's a done deal.
And we've heard the argument also that there's been disgruntlement with Trent Lott because he hasn't been tough enough in pushing the Republican agenda in the Senate. Is that also at work here?
Yeah, he's been a useless Senate Majority Leader when he was a Senate Majority Leader. It was partly his leadership that led to Jim Jeffords' defection, which handed the Senate to the Democrats. The only reason he's Senate Majority Leader now is because of George Bush and his ability to win the last congressional elections partly on his own personal appeal. So he has no real base support within the conservative wing of the party either.
Andrew Sullivan, stand by. I want to get Jack's response to your critique on the characterization of the Republican Party. Jack, Andrew says it's too broad.
Well, I wasn't saying that Republicans are racist. I didn't use that word at all. But to be against affirmative action, it seems to me, is to be against a program that benefits the economic and social mobility of African Americans.
And yet we know that there's an argument for that that's made not put forward on racist grounds, but on quite different grounds.
Well, quite. But I think the fact remains that this is a program that has benefited African Americans and that would continue to benefit them. So to be against that is to be against that benefit for African Americans.
If you think it's a benefit. As many African Americans do not believe it's a benefit. They think it's a condescending way in which people are promoted in ways that do not help their community, do not help the integration of black people into the broader society. There are genuine debates about this. To say that if you don't support that, you're somehow insensitive on racial issues seems to me to be pushing it way too far. So, you can have legitimate disagreements about affirmative action. And that's the problem. I think, you know, there are plenty of very radical racist elements in the Democratic Party as well. On the far left, you have people calling Colin Powell a house slave. You have all sorts of Uncle Tom references. You have black separatism. You have Jackson and Sharpton and the rest of it. You have all sorts of racism going on there as well. And if Jack was as tough on those people as many conservatives are being with Lott, we'd be in a better situation.
Andrew Sullivan, thanks for your perspective tonight.
You're welcome.
Thanks for joining us. Andrew Sullivan is senior editor at New Republic magazine and has a daily column at andrewsullivan.com. Thomas Edsel, wrap it up for us here. Do you agree? Do you handicap it the same way as Andrew Sullivan? Do you think Trent Lott is on his way out?
I think he is in. I would bet against him. I am a betting person, a poker player, and I would, if he was my hand, I'd fold.
And on the other side of that, a cleaner slate, a blemish erased by the Republicans as they head into a new campaign season.
Well, I think that Bush would very much like to see Bill Frist come in as the new majority leader.
The Tennessee senator
from Tennessee, who's a doctor, a moderate Southerner. I think they'd like to keep the guy, a Southerner, in that position, but to have a moderate there would strategically fit their bill perfectly.
Well, it may be that Trent Lott has a couple more weeks and not more. Thomas Edsel, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thomas Edsel is political correspondent for The Washington Post. He's author of Chain Reaction, The Impact of Race, Rights, and Taxes on American Politics. Jack Beatty, last thoughts.
Well, Robert Frost said poetry has only one subject, and he meant death. And in a similar way, I think American history has only one subject, and that is race.
Maybe so. And Trent Lott may take a little bit of that with him if and when he goes. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a look at Al Gore's decision to drop out of the presidential race. This is On Point. The field of Democratic presidential hopefuls was thrown wide open yesterday when Al Gore announced that he would not make his third run for the presidency. Gore made his announcement during an interview with Leslie Stahl on last night's 60 Minutes. At a press conference today in Raleigh, North Carolina, Gore expanded on his decision for reporters. Here are excerpts of what he had to say.
Because I have run for president twice before, and because a race this time around would have focused on a Bush-Gore rematch, I felt that the focus of that race would inevitably have been more on the past than it should have been when all races ought to be focused on the future. And in conversations around the country, it is completely understandable, but nevertheless a fact, that the conversations first and foremost tend toward the 2000 race, the Supreme Court decision, the idea of a rematch, and all the rest. And I think that for the values that I believe so strongly in, and for the best interests of our country, and for the political party that I'm a member of, which in my opinion, when it's at its best, it does serve as the best vehicle for those values. I thought for all those reasons, it was the right thing for me to decide not to be a candidate this time. And I made the decision, again, as I said last evening, in the full awareness that that probably means that I will never again have an opportunity to run for president. And I'm at peace with that decision. I was reminded about something my father said when he was defeated for his reelection to the United States Senate in 1970. It was a bitter race, and that was a tough one. When it was over with, he was trying to decide the very next day whether or not he was going to continue a career in politics or maybe do something entirely different. And he and I went out, just the two of us, on the Caney Fork River in a canoe. And as he was going over his options in his mind, he asked me for my advice. He said, you know, you served 32 years in the Senate and the House, and then this happens. What do you do? And my advice to him was, well, I'd take the 32 years, Dad. And in a sense, my decision over the last couple of days was a decision to take the 24 years.
Former Vice President Al Gore speaking today at a press conference in Raleigh, North Carolina. He was following up on yesterday's announcement on CBS's 60 Minutes that he will not seek the presidency in 2004. Jack Beatty, I said goodbye too early. You're listening along here with me. There's Al Gore saying a rematch would be a distraction. The dynamic of the rematch, he doesn't want that to distract.
I think he's right about that. If I may, I want to offer a two-handed assessment of Gore's career, mm-hmm. since it seems to be over now. On the one hand, he has shown an extraordinary aptitude for pushing issues and ideas. In the 80s, arms control, in the 90s, environmentalism. Even in the last campaign, his people against the powerful seems a lot more relevant now with Enron, etc., than it did even then. So he seems to have the future in his bones in terms of ideas. On the other hand, his political judgment is so bad. I mean, he lost Ohio by 3 points because he pulled out of there. He didn't make it a race. People were crying, come into Ohio. He didn't do it. He appointed Lieberman instead of Bob Graham. He was going to carry Connecticut anyway. He had to carry Florida. And, you know, when everything was on the line in the recount in Florida, the Republicans sent their ace, Jim Baker. Who did he send? Warren Christopher, a man who's barely sentient.
And then there's something not even in the moves, but just in the chemistry, there's something about this guy that didn't surprise us to see him having to concede, even when it was fought right to the wire.
No, I agree with you. There was a kind of self-defeating quality in the vice president. Someone told me that in the debate prep for the first debate, they said to him, "Don't sigh. Whatever you do, don't sigh." And the car got to the Kennedy Library in Boston, and they said to him again, "Do not sigh."
And we heard him apologizing on air last week for not sighing. But it's too cruel to send Al Gore off with that. As you say, he lofted a great many ideas, fought for them hard, and now he's made his decision. Off he goes.
Yes, and I think we'll be hearing from him, and especially on the environment, in years to come.
Jack, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.